A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one. He wants to talk about drip irrigation, the history, the invention, how it was pioneered in Israel, what the technology actually entails, and how it's reshaped agriculture in water-challenged parts of the world. And honestly, this is one of those topics where the most interesting stuff isn't the technology itself, it's everything around it. The economics, the unintended consequences, the fact that a technology proven for 60 years still only covers about 10% of global irrigated land.
The most transformative agricultural invention of the 20th century wasn't a tractor or a GMO seed. It was a plastic tube with holes in it. And the fact that adoption is still that low tells you there's a much deeper story here than just engineering.
Before we get into the global impact, let's be precise about what drip irrigation actually is. Because most people picture something quite different from the reality.
So drip irrigation, technically called micro-irrigation, is a system that delivers water directly to the root zone of plants through a network of valves, pipes, tubing, and emitters. The key difference from sprinklers or flood irrigation is the flow rate. We're talking 1 to 4 liters per hour per emitter. It's slow. The water seeps into the soil right where the plant can use it. Rather than flooding an entire field or spraying into the air where a huge percentage evaporates before it ever touches the ground.
It's the sloth of irrigation methods.
I was going to say it's precise and patient, but yes, fine, it's the sloth of irrigation. The emitter is the critical component. It's a small device, typically made of polyethylene, that attaches to the tubing at each plant. Inside, it has a labyrinthine flow path, basically a tiny maze, that reduces the pressure from the main line down to a trickle. That maze isn't just for pressure reduction. It creates turbulent flow, which keeps sediment particles suspended so they don't settle and clog the emitter. That was the breakthrough that made the whole thing commercially viable.
This is where the story gets genuinely interesting, because the core tension with drip irrigation is that it's simultaneously a triumph of engineering and a socioeconomic puzzle. It works brilliantly on a technical level, but the barriers to adoption have almost nothing to do with physics.
The technology can cut water use by 30-70% compared to flood irrigation, while increasing yields by 20-90% depending on the crop. Those numbers are not theoretical. They're documented across decades and dozens of countries. And yet, as of last year, only about 10% of global irrigated land uses drip irrigation. In a world where agriculture consumes 70% of all freshwater withdrawals and aquifers are depleting at alarming rates, that gap between what's possible and what's actually happening is the real story.
How did a leaky pipe in the desert become a multi-billion dollar industry? The story starts with a man named Simcha Blass and a very observant walk in 1933.
Simcha Blass was a Polish-born water engineer who immigrated to what was then British Mandate Palestine. He became the chief engineer of Mekorot, Israel's national water company. In 1933, he was visiting Kibbutz Na'an in the Negev Desert when he noticed something peculiar. There was a large, unusually healthy tree growing near a leaking water pipe. Everything around it was dry and sparse, but this one tree was thriving.
The most important agricultural innovation of the century starts with bad plumbing.
It really does. Blass realized the tree was benefiting from slow, continuous water delivery directly at the root zone. The leak was dripping water underground, right where the roots could access it, with no evaporation and no runoff. He filed that observation away and spent the next 2 decades thinking about how to replicate it intentionally. The observation was 1933. Commercial viability didn't come until the mid-1960s. That's over 30 years of iterative work. Blass conducted early experiments in the 1940s and 1950s, but the prototypes kept failing. The first design was basically a pipe with small holes punched in it. It clogged constantly, sand, silt, algae, mineral deposits. Anything in the water would block the holes within hours or days.
The entire feasibility of drip irrigation came down to solving a clogging problem.
And the solution was counterintuitive. You'd think the way to prevent clogging is to make the holes bigger or filter the water more aggressively. But Blass realized the emitter needed to be designed so that water moved through it turbulently, not in a smooth laminar flow. When water flows smoothly, particles settle out. When it's turbulent, they stay suspended and get flushed through. So he designed emitters with a labyrinthine internal path. The water twists and turns through a tiny maze, creating enough turbulence to keep particles moving while reducing pressure to a slow drip at the exit point.
It's basically the plumbing equivalent of driving on a winding mountain road instead of a straight highway. Harder to fall asleep at the wheel.
That's a surprisingly good analogy. And that labyrinthine design, refined over decades, is still the basis for most drip emitters manufactured today. But Blass had the idea. He didn't have the manufacturing capability. That's where the kibbutz connection comes in.
This is the part of the story that most people miss. It wasn't just an individual inventor in a garage. It was a specific institutional and social structure that made commercialization possible.
In 1959, Blass partnered with Kibbutz Hatzarim, a small community in the Negev. This wasn't random. Kibbutzim at that time had both agricultural expertise and the collective labor and capital needed to install and maintain experimental systems. A private farmer couldn't take the risk. A kibbutz could pool resources and absorb failures. Hatzarim's members started producing the first commercial drip irrigation systems in a small workshop. They called the company Netafim, which was formally founded in 1965.
That's a portmanteau, right?
Net means to sprout, and afim refers to the nose, the shape of the emitter. So the name literally means sprouting noses. The early products were crude, plastic tubing with hand-punched holes. But they worked, and they worked well enough that word started spreading.
This is happening against a specific political and economic backdrop that made drip irrigation almost inevitable in Israel.
1959 was a pivotal year for Israeli water policy. That's when the Knesset passed the water law, which nationalized all water sources in the country. Every drop of water, whether from a river, an aquifer, or rainfall, became public property managed by the state. The law established a centralized water authority that set quotas for every farmer. You couldn't just drill a well and pump as much as you wanted. You had an allocation, and if you exceeded it, you faced penalties.
Suddenly, the only way to increase agricultural output was to get more crop per drop.
Drip irrigation was the only technology that allowed farmers to increase production without exceeding their water quotas. It became a national priority. The government subsidized adoption. By 1970, Netafim had installed systems on about 500 hectares in Israel. By 1980, that number had grown to 50,000 hectares. A hundredfold increase in a decade, driven partly by the 1970s energy crisis, which made pumping water more expensive, and partly by the obvious yield improvements.
That brings us to the technical evolution, because the systems from 1970 are not what's being installed today.
Far from it. The 1970s saw the development of pressure-compensating emitters. In a field with any slope, emitters at the bottom of the hill get higher pressure than those at the top. Without compensation, you get uneven watering. Pressure-compensating emitters use a flexible diaphragm inside the emitter that adjusts the flow path based on incoming pressure. So every plant gets the same amount of water regardless of elevation. That was a huge advance for hilly terrain.
The 1980s brought self-flushing emitters.
These have a mechanism that briefly opens a wider passage at the start and end of each irrigation cycle, flushing out any accumulated debris. It's like the emitter coughs twice a day and clears its throat. That dramatically reduced maintenance requirements. Then the 1990s and 2000s brought computer-controlled systems with soil moisture sensors, weather station integration, and fertigation. Fertigation is the combination of fertilization and irrigation. You inject liquid fertilizer into the drip lines, so plants get precisely dosed nutrients along with water, delivered directly to the root zone.
You're not just saving water. You're saving fertilizer, reducing runoff into waterways, and preventing the leaf diseases that come from overhead sprinklers keeping foliage wet.
The secondary benefits are almost as significant as the primary ones. Less fungal pressure on leaves. Less weed grows between rows because only the crop root zone gets water. Lower labor costs because you're not moving sprinkler pipes. And in many crops, the yield improvements are dramatic. Tomatoes under drip irrigation can see yield increases of 50 to 90% compared to furrow irrigation. Cotton, 30 to 50%. These are not marginal gains.
Once the technology was proven in Israel, the question became, could it work everywhere? The answer turned out to be more complicated than anyone expected.
The first international installation was in Iran in 1968, which has a certain historical irony to it. Then Spain, Italy, and the United States in the 1970s. Today, Netafim operates in over 110 countries with more than 30 manufacturing facilities. Annual revenues exceed $1.5 billion. But the global spread hasn't been uniform, and some of the places that need it most have been slowest to adopt.
Let's talk about the success stories first. India is the big one.
India is fascinating. In 2000, India had about 150,000 hectares under drip irrigation. By 2025, that number exceeded 4 million hectares. That's a more than 25-fold increase in a quarter century. The driver was a combination of groundwater depletion and government subsidies. In Gujarat, the state government started subsidizing 50 to 70% of drip system costs in 2005. By 2020, Gujarat alone had 1.2 million hectares under drip irrigation, and groundwater levels in some districts stabilized for the first time in decades.
Stabilized groundwater is a huge deal. That's not just about farming. That's about whether entire regions remain habitable.
It really is. In parts of Gujarat and Rajasthan, farmers had been drilling wells deeper and deeper, chasing a falling water table. Drip irrigation reduced extraction enough that in some areas, the aquifer actually started recovering. That's a generational impact, and India has continued expanding. The national government's Pradhan Mantri Krishi Sinchai Yojana scheme has been pushing micro-irrigation aggressively, with a target of covering something like 10 million hectares eventually.
Then there's California.
California's Central Valley is one of the most productive agricultural regions on Earth, and it's also a hydrological disaster zone. Decades of groundwater overdraft have caused land subsidence in some areas of over 30 feet. The 2014 Sustainable Groundwater Management Act started forcing changes. Today, about 40% of California's irrigated cropland uses drip irrigation, roughly 1.6 million hectares out of about 4 million total. The rest still uses flood or sprinkler irrigation.
Even in California, with all its wealth and technology, less than half of irrigated land is on drip.
That gets to the barriers. A drip irrigation system costs between $500 and $2,000 per acre to install, depending on the crop, terrain, and system complexity. For a smallholder farmer in sub-Saharan Africa or South Asia, that's an impossible upfront cost. Even with subsidies, the financing mechanism matters enormously. And it's not just the money. Maintenance requires technical knowledge. Rodents chew through tubing. UV radiation degrades plastic over time. If you don't have access to replacement parts and the expertise to install them, the system degrades and eventually gets abandoned.
There's also the split incentive problem. If you're a tenant farmer renting land, why would you invest in a permanent irrigation system that benefits the landlord?
That's a huge barrier globally. In many countries, a significant percentage of farmland is rented. The landlord has no incentive to invest in drip irrigation because they're not paying the water bill or buying the fertilizer. The tenant has no incentive because they might lose the lease. The result is that neither party invests, and the field stays on flood irrigation. This is an institutional problem, not a technical one. Better emitters won't solve it. Land tenure reform or creative leasing arrangements might.
Then there's the Jevons paradox. This is where the story gets properly weird.
This is the part I find most fascinating and least discussed. The Jevons paradox, named after the 19th century economist William Stanley Jevons, describes a situation where efficiency improvements lead to increased total consumption rather than decreased. Jevons observed it with coal. As steam engines became more efficient, coal consumption didn't drop. It increased because efficient engines made coal power cheaper and more applications became economically viable.
The same thing happens with water.
Studies in multiple countries, including Spain, Morocco, and India, have found that when farmers switch to drip irrigation, they often expand their irrigated acreage or switch to more water-intensive, higher-value crops. The water they save per hectare gets used to irrigate more hectares. Total water consumption at the basin level doesn't decrease. It might even increase.
The technology solves the farm-level problem, but not the watershed-level problem.
If you're a farmer in Morocco and you switch from flood-irrigated wheat to drip-irrigated tomatoes, you're using water more efficiently per kilo of output. But tomatoes need more water per hectare than wheat. And you might be exporting those tomatoes to Europe, effectively exporting your water. At the farm level, you're more profitable. At the watershed level, the aquifer is still being depleted. The policy implication is that drip irrigation alone doesn't solve water scarcity. You need quotas, pricing, or regulatory limits to ensure that efficiency gains actually translate into reduced total extraction.
It's the technological equivalent of building more highway lanes to reduce traffic. The lanes fill up.
And this is why Israel's approach is instructive. Israel didn't just subsidize drip irrigation and hope for the best. The water law set hard quotas. If you saved water per hectare, you couldn't just expand your acreage. You had to stay within your allocation. The state managed the resource at the system level. That's the piece that's missing in most other countries.
Let's put some numbers on Israel's water transformation, because the scale of it is hard to overstate.
Israel's agricultural water consumption dropped from about 1.3 billion cubic meters in 1980 to roughly 1 billion cubic meters in 2020. Over the same period, agricultural output tripled. To put that in perspective, Israel produces about 70% of its own food and exports billions of dollars in agricultural products annually, all while using less water than it did 40 years ago. About 70% of Israel's irrigated land, roughly 220,000 hectares, uses drip irrigation. The country also recycles about 85% of its wastewater for agricultural use, far more than any other nation. Spain is second at about 20%.
That wastewater recycling stat is wild. 85% versus 20% for the runner-up.
It's not even close. And a lot of that recycled water is delivered through drip systems because you don't want to spray treated wastewater into the air where people might be exposed to aerosols. Drip irrigation puts it directly into the soil, which provides an additional treatment step through natural filtration.
What about the places where drip irrigation hasn't taken off? Sub-Saharan Africa, for instance.
Sub-Saharan Africa has some of the most water-stressed agricultural regions on Earth, and drip irrigation adoption remains extremely low. The reasons are mostly the ones we've already discussed. Upfront cost, lack of access to credit, limited technical support, and fragmented land holdings. But there's also a crop suitability issue. Drip irrigation is most economically viable for high-value crops, fruits, vegetables, vineyards, orchards. For staple grains like maize or millet, the economics are harder to justify, especially for smallholders growing for subsistence rather than market sale.
The technology is biased toward commercial agriculture.
It is, and that's a genuine limitation. There have been efforts to develop ultra-low-cost drip systems for smallholders. The International Development Enterprises, IDE, developed a bucket and hose system that uses gravity instead of pumps. A farmer fills a bucket or a barrel elevated a meter or two above the field, and water flows through simple tubing to emitters at each plant. No electricity, no pump, just gravity. These systems can achieve maybe 80% of the efficiency of a commercial drip system at 10% of the cost.
That's the kind of appropriate technology that actually changes lives.
The key to making it work is filtration. A $10 mesh filter at the inlet prevents 90% of clogging problems. Without it, the emitters clog and the whole system becomes useless within weeks. Filtration is not glamorous. Nobody gives awards for mesh screens. But it's the difference between a system that works for 5 years and one that works for 5 weeks.
The mesh filter is the unsung hero of this entire story.
I would absolutely argue that. The other unsung hero is the shift toward subsurface drip irrigation, or SDI. Instead of laying the drip tape on the surface, you bury it 10 to 30 centimeters underground. This eliminates evaporation losses entirely. Early adopters in Kansas and Nebraska are reporting 95% water use efficiency with SDI compared to maybe 85 to 90% for surface drip and 50 to 60% for sprinklers.
95% is getting close to theoretical maximum efficiency.
But the cost is 2 to 3 times higher than surface drip, and maintenance is more complicated because you can't visually inspect the emitters. If something clogs underground, you might not know until the plants start showing stress. There's also the issue of root intrusion. Some plant roots will grow into the emitters seeking water. So you need emitters impregnated with herbicides or designed with physical barriers. It's an active area of research and development.
There's the newest stuff. Solar-powered systems, biodegradable drip tape, AI-controlled irrigation.
The past 5 or 6 years have seen some interesting innovations. Solar-powered drip systems are a game-changer for off-grid areas. A small solar panel powers a pump that draws from a well or storage tank. No diesel, no grid connection, near-zero operating cost once installed. Companies like Sun Culture in East Africa are deploying these at scale, combining drip irrigation with pay-as-you-go financing using mobile money.
The financing innovation is as important as the hardware.
In many cases, more important. The biodegradable drip tape is another interesting development. Traditional drip tape is polyethylene, which lasts for years in the soil and creates a plastic waste problem when fields are replanted. Biodegradable tape made from materials like polylactic acid breaks down after 1 or 2 growing seasons. You plow it into the soil and it decomposes. The challenge is making it durable enough to last through a full growing cycle, but not so durable that it persists as waste. Getting that degradation timing right is harder than it sounds.
The AI side.
This is where things are heading. Systems that integrate soil moisture sensors, weather forecasts, and satellite imagery to adjust irrigation in real time. A satellite can measure evapotranspiration, basically how much water a crop is losing to the atmosphere, at the scale of individual fields. That data feeds into algorithms that tell the irrigation controller exactly how much water to apply and when. Netafim has a platform called NetBeat that does this. Other companies have similar offerings. The goal is to take the guesswork out of irrigation scheduling entirely.
The farmer becomes a system operator rather than a decision maker,
which is a profound shift in the relationship between farmers and their land. Some farmers love it because it reduces labor and improves yields. Others resist it because it feels like surrendering generations of accumulated knowledge to a black box. Both reactions are valid.
After 60 years of development and billions of dollars in investment, where does drip irrigation actually stand? And what can we learn from its uneven adoption?
The first lesson is that the biggest barrier to adoption isn't technology. It's the upfront cost and the split incentive problem. Policy solutions like subsidized financing, water pricing reform, or land tenure changes are often more impactful than better emitters. A well-designed subsidy program that covers 50 to 70% of installation costs, combined with technical training and access to replacement parts, can transform a region's agriculture in a decade. Gujarat proved that.
The second lesson is for the gardeners and small-scale farmers listening. You don't need a commercial system to get most of the benefits. A gravity-fed drip system using a barrel elevated a couple of meters, basic polyethylene tubing, and simple emitters can achieve remarkable efficiency. The critical component is a mesh filter at the inlet. Spend $10 on filtration before you spend anything on fancy emitters.
If you're in a water-stressed region, advocate for tiered water pricing that makes conservation economically rational. When water is priced below its true cost, there's no incentive for anyone to invest in efficiency. That's true whether you're talking about a 1,000-hectare farm or a suburban lawn.
The third lesson is for the tech people listening. The next big innovation in drip irrigation might not be in hardware at all. It might be in data analytics and soil sensing. The emitters are mature technology. The control systems and the integration with satellite data and weather modeling are where the frontier is. If you're an engineer or a data scientist interested in agriculture, that's the space to watch.
The fourth lesson, the one I think is most counterintuitive, is that drip irrigation doesn't automatically save water at the system level. The Jevons paradox is real. Efficiency without caps leads to expansion. If you want to solve water scarcity, you need both the technology and the regulatory framework. Israel's experience shows that the combination works. Other countries' experiences show that the technology alone does it.
There's something almost philosophical about that. The tool is only as good as the rules governing its use.
It's the difference between engineering and governance. Engineers can give you a system that delivers water with 95% efficiency. But governance determines whether that efficiency translates into aquifer recovery or just more tomatoes for export. One without the other is incomplete.
Where does this go next? As climate change intensifies droughts globally, will drip irrigation finally become the default, or will it remain a niche technology for high-value crops?
I think the pressure is only going to increase. The aquifers under the North China Plain, under the American High Plains, under the Indo-Gangetic Plain, they're all being depleted. At some point, the depletion becomes so severe that the choice isn't between drip and flood irrigation. It's between drip and abandoning agriculture in that region entirely. When you reach that point, the economics shift dramatically.
Necessity is the mother of adoption.
The subsurface drip irrigation I mentioned earlier, the buried systems with 95% efficiency, that's probably the long-term destination for permanent crops and high-value annuals. The cost needs to come down, and the maintenance challenges need to be solved, but the trajectory is clear. And the integration with renewable energy for pumping, with desalination where coastal aquifers are saline, with precision fertigation to reduce nutrient pollution. All of these pieces fit together into a system that's more efficient at every level.
It's the agricultural equivalent of moving from incandescent bulbs to LEDs. Same function, radically different resource intensity.
That's exactly the right framing. And like LEDs, the upfront cost is higher, but the lifetime cost is lower. The challenge is helping farmers, especially smallholders, bridge that upfront gap. That's a finance and policy problem, not an engineering problem.
On that note, the open question I'd leave listeners with is this. We've had commercially viable drip irrigation for 60 years. It's proven, it's reliable, and the efficiency gains are enormous. And yet, only 10% of global irrigated land uses it. What does that tell us about how technology actually spreads, and about which problems are really technical versus institutional?
It tells us that invention is maybe 10% of the work. The other 90% is adoption. And adoption is about money, power, habits, institutions, and incentives. The plastic tube with holes in it was the easy part.
Now, Hilbert's Daily Fun Fact.
In the 1840s, the Faroe Islands nearly became the site of the world's first subsea telegraph observatory. A Danish physicist proposed laying an experimental cable from the islands to Iceland to measure deep ocean temperature variations in real time. The project was abandoned when the cable manufacturer realized they had no ship capable of carrying the weight of the copper conductor across the North Atlantic, and the entire concept of submarine telegraphy was shelved for another decade.
The Faroe Islands almost became the birthplace of oceanography, and the whole thing fell apart because the boat wasn't big enough.
That is such a specific failure mode. We have the science, we have the cable, we do not have a boat that can carry it.
This has been My Weird Proms. Thanks to our producer, Hilbert Flumingdop. If you enjoyed this episode, please take a moment to rate and review the show. It helps other curious minds find us. I'm Korn.
I'm Herman Pobbleberry. See you next time.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Proms, where odd thoughts go. From sloth's slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.